My name is Snowflake, and I'm an alcoholic. I had a dream last night that I got introduced to tell my story, and somebody was talking in the back of the room, and I raised my voice to just try to get attention, and then all of a sudden, everybody just started to leave. And the only people that were left was my mom and a scientist who was studying alcoholics. So there's a little peek inside my mind. My sobriety date is December 18th of 2008. And that's a miracle. I didn't know I was an alcoholic until I stopped drinking. But it turns out I was. And I've never told my story before, so thank you for letting me be of service. I'm going to tell you what I used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I have people in the room that are part of my sobriety that I love dearly. My husband is here. My sponsor, Jennifer, is here. My friend, Desdemona. Sorry, I'm breaking your anonymity. Like me, she has the least anonymous name. My dear friend Laura and my dear friend Amanda, and all of these people are huge parts of my sobriety. My husband is my full partner. He's a courageous man in recovery. His courage, but also the wreckage of his addiction, propelled me into sobriety. So he's a big part of this story. And my sponsor is a bright light. She's just compassionate and she's cheerful, and I just text her like, here's what I did for my sobriety today, and every time she's like, yeah, you did a great job. So that's really nice to hear. And then the friends that I've made in recovery, the people that I've been attracted to in recovery are the people that are that very consistently ask, what's my part in it? And the people that I've made friends with in recovery are people that are desperately fervent to be in recovery, that they do their recovery like it's life and death, and because it is. Okay, so what it was like. I was born in rural South Dakota. I was born to hippies. I was born to two people who named me Snowflake Rosen. My dad was upper middle class and Jewish. My mom was Catholic. They had both abandoned their religions and really any kind of spirituality and come together and got married. They both grew up in Philadelphia, but moved when my mom was pregnant with me in the winter of 1973 to the Black Hills of South Dakota, to nothing. Like, just, you know, there are 500,000 people in the whole state of South Dakota. And what the first part of that life was kind of idyllic and hippie. Like, my mom grew a garden. They sold pot and peyote. Like, they sold things that came out of the ground. So it was, like, you know, kind of, like, acceptable and hippie. And that went on until I was about six. And then my mom said to my dad, you have to stop dealing drugs. We've got two kids. I had a four-year-old sister. And my dad said, I'm never going to stop dealing drugs. And that was the choice that he made and left our family. I was six. My sister was four. And my mom didn't have a college degree. She was on public assistance the first year that she was divorced. And she didn't have any resources at all to basically stop the anger that my dad had for having been abandoned. And so he stayed in South Dakota. We all stayed in the same town of 200 people. And he actively sabotaged my mom. reported her to public assistance. He came and picked up a freezer that we had winter food in and took it. He was so angry at having been abandoned and took that opportunity to really fight, you know, really basically to trash my mom and to actively work against our success. So that went on for a while. I sometimes describe my dad as the worst parent you could have had, except that he didn't beat us or sexually abuse us directly. But he was very emotionally abusive, very negligent, very angry. He hated my mom, he hated his mom and his sisters, and he hated women. His hippie drugs, this is a progressive illness, his hippie drugs turned into cocaine. And when I was between 6 and 10, when I was in his house, he was always dealing drugs. He always had weapons in his house. He slept with a revolver under his pillow. When people came into the driveway, he would have a gun like this, and he would look out the window. So that was the second part of my childhood. And the other thing that my dad's addiction did is that he left us alone sometimes. So he would leave the house and leave me and my sister in the house alone, you know, at 7 and 5 in the middle of the night so that he could go out and deal. By the time I was offered substances, it did not occur to me to say no, because that was just part of my life. And so anytime anybody put anything in my face, I just said yes to it. And the first time that I took a drink, I was 13. I was at a pool party with my cousin, and it was like coming home. It was like something went like this, and I discovered the feeling of not being anxious and the feeling of not feeling apart from. I discovered the feeling of being a part of. And it was a relief, and it was a like a love. The other thing that happened that night, and these two things will be inextricable in my story, is that I made out with a boy. And of course, that was the same high. It was a different kind of high, but it was the same high. And so for me, drinking and sexual expression were just bound together like perfect friends. And from that time, I drank alcoholically from 13 until 34. And I didn't know I was an alcoholic the whole time. I thought addicts were my dad, basically. Like, I thought cocaine was addiction. I kind of just thought most of the time that I was a pretty fun party girl. And I was fun. You can ask my husband. So I had these kind of like periods of life, like the, you know, hippie kind of idyllic childhood, this very, very chaotic, very scary part where my dad still had custody of us, was dealing actively, my mom couldn't get us away from him. And then, of course, the other thing that happened in my dad's care is that he left us, me and my sister, in the care of bad men who did not respect little girls. And there were several times that I was sexually abused under my dad's care by friends that he had left us with. When I was 12, my dad had this friend, Joe, and he was if you ever know anything about South Dakota, one of the subcultures there is bikers. So like my dad turned into this cocaine-snorting biker. And he had, you know, cocaine-snorting biker friends. And Joe was one that would just, I was probably 12 years old, and he would just come over and leer at me, just stare at me, and make comments about me. And I just felt totally unsafe. And one day he trapped me on the stairs and grabbed me by the chest and, like, you know, felt my chest and wouldn't let me go. He was huge. He was probably 200 pounds. And I told my dad, and my dad laughed, and he said, "Ah, Joe felt Snowflake up." So that was the kind of protection and parenting that I got from my male parent. And the message that that gave to me was that I wasn't really worth it, that my body wasn't worth it, that my sexuality was kind of dangerous, that men were pretty dangerous. And so I think, you know, the sort of coming together of men and sex and drinking gave me a power that I had not had and that specifically felt very powerless about. So when I was 13, my mom got remarried. We moved to Rapid City, which is a town in South Dakota. It's the second largest town in South Dakota. It's 50,000 people. So it was the big city. Huge. My stepdad was beginning to be a successful entrepreneur, and so was my mom, actually. She's a real survivor. And so basically overnight, I became middle class. Like, all of a sudden, I'd come out of this rural background where we were poor and on public assistance, and then all of a sudden, I was middle class. And if you're my age, you'll remember, like, Oakleys and Reeboks and Vans. So I had all of that stuff. And so I kind of, all of a sudden, I had like all the trappings of what looked like a normal kid. But inside, I just felt totally chaotic. And I just started drinking my ass off. Like, I was like, I was not ever a daily drinker, but I was just a binge drinker, and I just didn't say no. And at that time in South Dakota, we didn't have a lot of access to, like, the white drugs that we have today. Like, there was no such thing as Oxy, and there was no cocaine, except what my dad was doing, I guess. I never got it from him. But I did all the psychedelics and did a lot of drinking in high school. The other thing that I learned in high school was how to be broken on the inside but look really normal on the outside. So I was a good student, and I was a friend and a popular student. I had lots of friends of all different kinds. I got really good grades, but I was just acting out all over the place underneath. And what I learned in my household was to just play by the rules, but literally sneak out at night and do whatever I wanted to do. And so that was my MO. I was not a kind of fuck it kid who just threw everything away. Like, I was like, I'm going to get A's and I'm going to go to college, but I'm going to, like, binge drink on the weekends and sleep around. So I loved high school. I loved drinking and drugs. By this time, my dad had gone to jail. My dad was arrested for selling cocaine to an undercover cop. He went on the run for the better part of a year. So I had a fucking outlaw dad. While I was trying to be middle class, I was working at Little Caesar's Pizza, and I had to tell my boss, like, my dad's getting out of jail. I need the night off. So while my dad was in jail, he was in jail for 2.5 years in federal prison in South Dakota, I told him once on a visit that I had done LSD. And he said, you should try mushrooms. So that was the kind of parenting I got. God, I didn't realize this was all going to be so much about my dad. Surprise! So let me see. I can yada yada through some of the what it was like. I mean, I don't have, like, amazing drunkalogs. I think I told you I just was a party girl. Like, I just loved it. It was fun. I felt great doing it. I said yes to drugs. I said yes to alcohol. My first boyfriend. So here's the part where I'll tell you, like, addicts have bad pickers. We just pick over and over bad everything, bad friends, bad whatever. And my first boyfriend was a hippie. He was 4.5 years older than me. He had a ponytail. He went to school in Colorado. He had an RX-7. I walked up to a party one night and I saw his RX-7 and I was like, yep. So Ty was my first boyfriend. Ty Stick, we call him, of course. And within the first year we were dating, he got arrested driving from Boulder to Rapid City with pounds of mushrooms and pot in his car and went to jail. So as I was writing out my notes, I thought, God, I fucking think I had a boyfriend and a dad in jail at the same time. So I went to school in Boulder because Ty was in Boulder. So I started college in 1992. And I was really scared about going to college. I knew I was going to go to college. By that time, my family was kind of like upper middle class, and it was pretty natural that we were going to go to college. And looking back, one other pattern that I can see in my life is that every time I've done a geographical move, it's been followed by just immense drinking. So every, you know, going to college, moving from college, moving in adulthood in before I got into sobriety, I just coped with the disruption of moving and the fear of it and the having to make new friends by drinking a lot, and it was no different in Boulder. So I broke up with Ty right away and became single. And the first bottom that I hit in my life was not an alcohol bottom. It was an eating disorder bottom. And it happened in my junior year in high school, or in college. So I was, I had started to binge and purge, and it got to a point where I couldn't do my schoolwork anymore. And so I was just finally, like, for me, school had been, that's the signal to put our kids to bed. So remember I told you I discovered how to look normal on the outside but be broken on the inside. And when I was in my first 3 years in college, I was getting good grades. I was drinking a lot, but so was everybody else that I knew. And I basically said to myself, like, I could tell that I was losing control of my eating disorder, but I said, as long as I'm getting good grades, I'll be fine. And then I stopped being able to do my schoolwork, and I knew that I needed help. So I dropped out of school, and I went to an intensive outpatient program for women in recovery, women of all kinds. So I had an eating disorder. There were alcoholics in the program, and there were women that were addicted to prescription drugs in the program. And in that program, they encouraged me to stop drinking. And I was like, oh, that's cute. I'll stop drinking for like a hot second. I don't even remember how long it was. I was not serious about it. I think I did stop drinking for several months, but I wasn't serious about it. And at that time, I didn't see the relationship between my eating disorder, my drinking, my sexual acting out, my hatred of my body, whatever it was, over exercise, like you name it, I'll cycle through anything to feel better. And so I got better from the acute eating disorder, but I just kept drinking and drinking. I didn't get to, I think with the eating disorder, I got to step one. I understood that I was powerless because I didn't want to be doing it, but I was doing it. I did not come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And so in that program, I was in an OA program, an Overeaters Anonymous. It was a 12-step program. And they encouraged you to envision and find a higher power. And I, like, made some shit up about angels. Oh, because I also had a women's studies degree. And so I didn't want to say that God was a he. So I made some shit up about angels, but I didn't believe it. And I just kept drinking. And I went to a couple AA meetings, and I did not identify. Like, I was like, that's not me. I think I went to an AA meeting in Rapid City, and I was like, that's not me. I'm just a fun college party girl. So my second bad picker, my second love, was an alcoholic. She was 11 years older than me. She had a red sports car. There's something about sports cars. And she just needed somebody to fix, and I just needed somebody to fix me. And we were together for about 3.5 years and just drank all the time. I ended up graduating from college. All of my relationships I've cheated on. And that's how that one ended. And in 1999, I called my parents and I said, I need a plane ticket and $1,000 because I got to leave Colorado or else, because I, you know, we'd been together, broken up, moved back in together. And I just said, I've got to leave this relationship and I've got to leave the state. And so my parents bailed me out. I went to Boston and I swore that I was going to be single for a year. And I moved in with my sister. I was a fun party girl. Started stealing pills from her roommate who had all kinds of mental health issues. And and I made the final pick. And it was the worst pick of my life and also the best pick of my life. Just for today, as far as I know. So my third love is my husband. He came from a nuclear family. He had like a mom and a dad that still lived together, that weren't divorced. His dad's a doctor. He went to an Ivy League school. He was like tall and athletic. He played football. And I was like, score. He isn't the trash that I am. And, you know, and I just thought, like, those are the types of external things that are going to protect me from what has been. And so our relationship started in infidelity. He had a girlfriend. And we had an affair, and we became friends first. We legitimately became friends first. But it was not a great start to a relationship. And we just drank all the time. And he drank as much as I did. And he was, like, super fun. And he was, like, fun guy, and I was, like, fun girl. And we had fun friends. And is that funny? So that kept going. We met when I was 25. We got married when we were 29, and we came here to Austin in 2006. We were both working. We didn't have kids. We'd been married for 3 years. And this is the what happened part of the story. And let me just set a little context. So we had a condo. We both had good jobs. We had a Montero Sport. And an early model BMW. And I thought, like, you know, I looked good on the outside. Like, it just looked like, it looked good on the outside. Like, we had a house and jobs. And I thought, I have this husband who's a faithful and great husband. And yeah, I mean, we drink on the weekends. And I guess sometimes I swear that I'm going to not drive home drunk, but I do. But we had a bunch of friends, and they were, like, snorting coke when we were just drinking, and I was like, well, we're not doing that. And so that's kind of, I mean, I don't know how much longer that would have gone on, potentially forever. But here's what happened, and it catches up to you. It just fucking catches up to you. Like, this can't go on. So on August 17th of 2008, we had gone out downtown in Austin. We'd done ecstasy, stayed up all night, you know, whatever, carousing. My husband had friends in town. And the next night, they were all going out, and I just stayed home. I wasn't feeling well. I wasn't always like a two binges in a row person because I wasn't an alcoholic. Or so I thought. So everybody gets home at maybe like 3, and I hear them come in, and I sort of doze back to sleep, and I wake up, and my husband is not in bed. And that's kind of unusual. Like, that's, he usually comes up to bed, or he's down on the couch, like, picking apart a rotisserie chicken and passed out. So I walk downstairs. I walk downstairs, and I see my husband sitting at our kitchen island with his laptop open in front of him, and he slumped over, passed out, and I'd never seen him with his laptop open like that. And every hair on the back of my neck just went up. And I walked over, and I jiggled the mouse tracker, and up popped a spouse's worst nightmare. Just a Pandora's box of sex addiction that I, until that moment, had no idea was going on. So my husband, we'd been married almost 5 years, we'd been together 4 years before that, had been hiding from me an addiction and had never been faithful in our relationship. And I was shattered. I was shattered. In that very moment, everything that I knew about being a fun party girl and having a good job and driving a BMW and a Montero Sport and living in a house in 78704 was totally undone. And so I went upstairs, and he followed me upstairs crying and pleading, and I hit him. I broke his computer. I threw stuff. And I kicked him out. I did not know what kind of sociopath I had married. And I woke up his friends and kicked them out. I called his parents and told them what I'd found, and I called my parents and told them what I'd found, and I watched the Montero Sport fucking drive away at 5 a.m, and I went back into my house, and I was like, what is this life? What has happened to me? So, so that was my second bottom, after having an eating disorder. And in the months that ensued, my husband went off to a residential treatment program for sex addicts. I stayed in Austin and just got in total fuck it mode. I was like, well, sure, I'll do cocaine. Sure, I'll hook up with the spinning teacher at my gym. Like, how much worse could it get, basically? And so what happened? Shattered spinning teacher cocaine. Those are my notes. So in September, so this was late August, sometime in late September, I got a letter from my husband, and he said, I'd like you to come to Family Week. And part of me just felt like, I just have to know what happened to me. Like, this Ivy League, you know, kid of a doctor, like, and this was before Tiger Woods and, you know, like, we didn't have a discourse around sex. Well, I mean, we still don't, but there wasn't even a pop culture reference to it at that time. So I went to Ogue's Family Week, and I saw a different human being. Like, I was gobsmacked by how different he was. And what I realized in that weekend was that he had broken his own heart, and that he had ruined his own life. And it didn't, I don't think I knew at that time that it didn't have anything to do with me, but I saw a very different husband, one who was much more humble, much more vulnerable. And so I went back to Austin thinking, maybe there's a chance for us, because I had already served him divorce papers. And but I was also sliding down in my own addiction. So I thought, well, I'll go to Al-Anon, because my husband's an addict. Because they had encouraged us to go to Essanon and Al-Anon. So I went to the Westlake Austin clubhouse, and, you know, I, like, sneaked in from the parking lot, and the clubhouse has a hallway, and it has several different rooms, and I didn't want to ask anybody anything. And so I just sneaked into a room and sat down, and I thought I was in an Al-Anon meeting. I think I'd found it on the website. You know it's coming. It was an AA meeting, and I cried the whole time. This was sometime in September or early October 2008, and I felt a relief in that hour that I had not felt in the desperation and pain since discovering what was going on with my husband. And so I was also in therapy at the time, and my therapist was in the program. She was an alcoholic. So I kept going to AA, and I just treated AA like it was like therapy. I was still drinking, but I would go to AA because I felt better. And, but I thought, like, oh, this is probably good for me because my husband's an addict, and if we get back together, I'm sure I'm going to need some kind of program. So in December, my therapist asked me, why are you going to AA and still drinking? And I said, well, because I'm not an alcoholic. And she said, why don't you try to stop drinking? And just except for that one hot minute in 1995, I had never tried to stop drinking because I never thought I was an alcoholic. And so I stopped drinking. And I really legitimately stopped drinking. Like, I've not had a drink since December 18th of 2008. I didn't get better right away. I stopped drinking in mid-December, New Year's Eve. Ogue was back in Austin, but we weren't living together. We were going to therapy very, very regulated. Like, you know, every time I saw my husband after he got back from Austin from treatment, I had a PTSD reaction. Like, my arms would literally go numb from the trauma and betrayal of what he had done to me. And so we were not, I didn't even know if we were still going to be together, but we were going to therapy. And on New Year's Eve of 2008, the first New Year's Eve that I had spent sober since I was probably 13, I went to a friend's party, some good, healthy friends. I went straight to the bar, ordered a Diet Coke, and then nursed my little Diet Coke all night long, totally sober. I was like, I'm going to go home. I'm not drinking, not going to hook up with anybody. And sure enough, sat down next to a guy, and I didn't even like him. And he ended up in my bed. And I woke up that morning, January 1st, 2009, like with what felt like a hangover, even though I had not had a drop to drink, and with the dawning realization that I had bigger problems than a husband who was a sex addict, that I had brought with me to all my relationships my own addiction, and had only ever been in love with addicts because I was one. And so I went to, I signed up for a one-week intensive program at a treatment program in Arizona, and I got into there, and I was ready to be honest. Like, I was pretty sure I was in trouble. And so I just started spilling everything I'd been doing, and they took one look at me in that one-week program, and they're like, you need to come back and check yourself in. So I came back to Austin. I went to inpatient treatment in May of 2009. I'd been sober from drugs and alcohol for 5 months at that time. And I was in treatment. After a couple of weeks, they had put a girl. I was in treatment with, my primary group was a lot of sex addicts. And I thought they'd put me in there because my husband was a sex addict. You're just so dumb in addiction. And then they put a girl in there who was a sex addict, and my primary counselor said something like, I think you guys could really, you know, yeah, whatever she said, so, like something that gave me the impression like, oh, she put her in here because I'm in here. what was I talking about? So what it's like today. So the miracle of recovery is that my marriage survived. And I am not a traditional, like, I didn't, you know, I wasn't like the princess on a white horse marriage kind of person. I fell in love with my husband. We got married, felt very natural. But I didn't want to fight for that marriage because I didn't feel like he had, I mean, he had not married me in good faith. But as we both were in Austin and followed our own individual programs of recovery, so when I came back from treatment, I went to SLAA, I went to Essanon, I went to AA, and slowly, under a lot of care, we started to heal together as a couple. And given the things that he had done in his active addiction, I would never have believed it. And if a woman came to me and said, my husband did these things, before this experience, I would have said to her, get rid of that guy. But what I saw in my husband was that earnestness and desperation to be sober that I talked about at the beginning of this. And so that's been my own sobriety has been a great miracle of recovery, but my husband's sobriety and the recovery of my marriage has been a great miracle of this program. And it would not have happened without the 12 steps. I'm sure of that. So what it's like today is I know I'm an alcoholic because when I stopped drinking, everything got better. Everything. Across the board. There isn't one thing that's worse than it was before December 18th of 2008. Maybe my knees, but I'm 10 years older. I had to introduce myself as an alcoholic and not quibble with, like, but I didn't drink every day, but I never did this, I never got a DUI, I never went to jail. I stopped all of that. And because what I thought, like, you drive a BMW and you live in a condo, you're not an alcoholic. So I love saying that I'm an alcoholic because it reminds me that I'm an alcoholic. I had to stop arguing. So again, like, the first step wasn't hard. This second time, the second step wasn't hard because I was ready to give up. I had the gift of desperation. I didn't have another way to go. And I knew, because of the pain that I was in, that everything, every decision and every thought and everything I thought, like, I'm doing it the right way, was so wrong, and it got me exactly where I was. And so coming to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity was, like, such a beautiful, beautiful concept and such a relief. The third step, I think you just probably work on every single minute. You know, I'm an addict. I love taking control. I'm a first child. I'm a salesperson. I'm a mom. You know, I like to take control, but every time I do, it's like it doesn't go the right way. I have a sponsor. I have had three sponsors in recovery. I kind of had a bad sponsor picker, too. Like, the first two sponsors I picked, I just wanted, like, real disciplinarians. The first sponsor I picked made me call five different women a day. Oh, my God, I felt like I was in junior high. So my sponsor, Jennifer, and I, we check in just about every day. I'm working through the fourth step right now. I've never sponsored a woman in recovery, and I'm really looking forward to that. I have a 7 and a 5-year-old, so I've been, like, sponsoring my own children, but now I'm ready to give that part back to another woman in recovery. So it's my goal this year to get passed by Jennifer and qualified to sponsor another woman. I had another bottom. It wasn't like a really deep rock bottom, but I had another bottom about 7 years sober. And it was with anxiety. Because I think that I probably started drinking because I had anxiety, because my fucking dad dealt cocaine out of my house when I was trying to eat Cheerios. So... So I was totally sober, going to therapy, going to meetings about 3 years ago, and I found myself, like, just crippled by anxiety. And one night in Dallas Love Field, coming home from a work meeting, I was sitting in the middle of the airport sobbing out loud like my life was ending. And I could just say, like, marriage, healthy kids, I've got enough money, I've got a good job, I'm healthy. And none of those things mattered. I was powerless. And so I got onto an SSRI, a anxiety medication, and that has made a huge difference in my recovery as well. And it was humbling to do that because I don't like to take medication anymore. But I needed to take that medication. That's like medication from a doctor is okay. So I'm so glad to be sober. I am so glad to be sober. It's a miracle. When I hear somebody say I've been sober for 24 hours or I've been sober for 45 years, that's the same miracle. it's the same miracle because not everybody gets a chance. And so getting free of substances, that's just the beginning. That's what you have to do to heal. But now with the 12 steps, like, we have a program. We have a design for living. We have it's a checklist. And get a sponsor, and that sponsor will be a person who tells you the truth, if it's the right sponsor. And if it's not, then you just find another one. You practice breaking up with somebody in a normal way, which I've never done. So I appreciate you guys not leaving the room like my dream. Wait, I'll tell you one more thing, which is this other reminder that I get from my higher power. The first reminder is introducing myself as an alcoholic, but the second reminder is that about every 2 to 3 months, I have a dream that I have drunk, that I've gotten drunk, and I'm trying to hide it, and I'm trying to figure out how do I not reset my sobriety date. And that is an incredible reminder that I'm an alcoholic, because normal people do not have that dream. They don't. It wouldn't even occur to them. But I have a dream where I'm like, fuck, how did I get drunk? And now how am I going to hide it? So that's good. So thank you. I'm Snowflake, and I'm an alcoholic.